So today's lecture, we're going to talk about non-locality and what I'm going to do first is explain to you as the CHSH game. And so what this will do is illustrate why there's something special happening here. So the CHSH game is this. You have two parties, Alice and Bob. Okay, and they're going to be put into these electromagnetically shielded boxes at some time t0, which is the start of the game. Prior to entering the box, they can concoct any plan they want. Okay, they can consult with each other. So let me just say here, they are advised in advance of the full rules of the game. But once they enter the boxes, when the game starts, they can no longer communicate. Now, we can do this on the honor system, or we can do this by putting them inside electromagnetically shielded boxes. We can put them in blindfolds, and we can put earmuffs on them. And then we can teach them to read Braille, okay? Is this how you spell Braille? B-R-A-I-L? I'm sorry? Thank you. Okay, so now the rules of the game are that in each round, K, a referee will ask them a random question. We'll ask each of them uniformly at random. Either question 0 or question 1. Let me call it Q0 or Q1. Question Q0 or question Q1. These questions are yes, no, these have yes, no answers. Okay. They have to answer,
both the same question or different?
Uniformly and independently at random. I meant to say independently, thank you. So Alice and Bob must provide independently and without communicating, which is redundant with rule 2. Communicating, okay, see rule 2. Either answer 0 or answer 1. What do you think of as yes and no? Oh, by the way, Aggie, did you get a chance to post the notes on the wiki? Great, so the notes are on the wiki. So you can follow this on your device if that's easier than writing everything down. Actually, this is just one paragraph in the notes, and I'm making it much more elaborate. This is at the CHS game is at the end of the chapter I just provided to you, but I'm going to do it first because I realized while coming in that I think it's best to do this first. Okay, so now the constraint, rule 5 is the constraint. For any good game, you have to know the winning condition. What's the goal? So the winning condition is that if let's call if Q the constraint is a table, which is here's Alice's question, Bob's question. So if Alice has asked question Q0 and Bob has answered Q0 and asked Q0, then the answers, their answers should agree. Let's call the answers, let's use a label, let's call it A0 and B0. That's probably bad notation. Let's call it X and Y. XA and YB. XA, YB. So XA is Bob's answer. XA is Alice's answer. YB is Bob's answer. So these are both elements of the pairs. These have to be answers 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. These are the four possible answers we can get in any round. So here we want the answers to agree. This means we want XA to equal YB. If Alice has asked Q0 and Bob has asked Q1, we also want the answers to agree. If Alice has asked Q1 and Bob has asked Q0, we want the answers to agree. And if Alice has asked Q1 and Bob has asked Q1, we want the answers to disagree. So it doesn't matter what they answer. What matters is the correlations between the answer. Okay, suppose I change this rule. Suppose I ask that their answers agree on the fourth line. Then what's a recipe for winning this game? Everybody just says zero all the time. Exactly. So this introduces a non-trivial constraint, because now if they answer zero all the time, they'll win only 75% of the time, because these are uniformly random questions. Is there a strategy where they can do better than 75%? They can answer anything they want. Well, the answer has to be 0 or 1.
But then the judge gives them points if they both rest to 0.
Yeah, so they win a round if they meet this condition. So this is to win a given round if the answers agree, disagree. And then the question is, what is the maximum fraction of games they can win? Of rounds they can win. Yes. That's the rules of the game. Games are arbitrary. Rules of games are arbitrary. So this is just we're defining a game. So we want the goal of the game is for the answers to agree under these scenarios. Okay. There's no reason for it. It's just we're defining a game and we're saying how well can we do at this game. So what's the best strategy? The rules aren't clear. Let's be clear about this, because this is the easy part. Things get a lot more complicated after this.
Okay, so suppose they ask Q0, both of them, but one of them says 1 and the other says 0.
Then they lose. They lose that round.
Okay. And so they could, but they could, they know after, before they get into the chamber, that they could agree that if we are ask Q0, we answer yes.
Yes, they can make that plan.
They can make that plan.
So then they say, whenever you get asked Q0, always answer yes. So that means,
so Bob would have known if Alice's question was
really, yeah, that's fine. Whenever they ask Q0, answer yes.
They would still lose.
What happens there?
Half of the round.
So that means, you know, in these three conditions, yes is one. What would we call yes? Instead of say yes, let's say zero. So answer zero if you're asked Q0. So here, they both answer zero, they win. Here, Alice answers zero. Here, Bob answers zero. So now the only way they can win is if they also answer zero to Q1. But then they're both answering zero here,
sure.
So So they lose. So they still are only winning 75% of the time. Any other ideas? Do you guys want to think about this some more, this brain teaser? Mm-hmm. Yes, they can use coin tosses. The question is, will that help them do better than 75%? So I'm going to prove to you today that they can't do better than 75% unless they have quantum technology. With quantum technology, they can do better than 75%. Okay, without violating any of these conditions. Okay, so that's what's, this is why non-locality is interesting. It's enabling, okay? So just one of the core messages I want to give to you, which I'm not supposed to tell you, okay, is that, discussions of non-locality, which started with Einstein, who supposedly didn't understand quantum mechanics, and actually was the one who realized that there was a conflict between quantum mechanics and non-locality, and continued on for decades with John Bell, who then studied how any hidden variable model has to be non-local. And people said, oh, well, non-locality is ridiculous, so therefore hidden variables are ridiculous, not realizing that if you deny hidden variables, Einstein had already showed that you get non-locality. That was Einstein's point. So it was actually, Bell's theorem is often misinterpreted as being an argument against hidden variables. It's actually, it already was an argument against denying hidden variables. And Bell showed it's still a problem with hidden variables. Not that it's a new problem that arises for hidden variables. So that's the common misconception. So people dismissed it as sophistry, as philosophy, as metaphysics. But now it turns out, thanks to Bennett and Broussard, or more precisely Eckert in 1991, it became clear that the non-locality of quantum mechanics is a resource that can be leveraged to enable capabilities that were impossible previously. Okay, so any other questions about the setup of this game? Because basically, Bell's theorem is a mathematical statement of the fact that the largest win percentage of this game is 75% classically. That's all it's telling you, and that's all you need. Why in Braille? Well, they have earmuffs on, right? Because they can't communicate. They have noise-canceling, really high-quality Bose noise-canceling earphones. So they can't communicate, all right? Because although this is an EM shield, we could still detect vibrations with our inner ear. So I'm preventing that. All right? Yeah, and they have to, well, they can speak their answers. Oh, but yeah, they couldn't, yeah. The noise-canceling earphones, actually, they can, they're like, blind, deaf, mute, whatever. They're not mute, right? So, because even if Alice spoke her answer, Bob can't hear it because he has these really high quality. Now, the point is also, what this also does is shows you that the question of relativity is somehow irrelevant, right? Because this is an interesting problem even when they're not space-like separated, if we just make certain plausible assumptions about their communication. The only point of relativity is so they can take off their earphones and they can take off their blindfolds and we can still be confident that they're not communicating. So that's the only thing relativity does, is it gives us a good physical reason to expect that we've met these conditions.
So there's no difference if they play the game simultaneously or if one of them plays after the other?
No difference at all. As long as there's no communication. As long as you're confident they're not communicating, then you're confident the best they can do is 75%. Okay, good. So now let's look at the brass tacks, so to speak. So we imagine that we have, let's look at the experimental setup. So we have a source. Okay, now I'm just going to follow pretty much what's in your notes if you wish to read along. We have a source. Something invisible comes out of the source. So we could draw it the way we usually draw it if you wish. There's two outputs. And then Alice and Bob are over here, and they've got their detectors, which are measurement devices. So these are just, this is described by postulate one. This is described by postulate, whatever I called it, two or three on measurement. These both have pointers and dials. And I guess the light, which says that they detected an event. And now the point is the dial setting is the choice of measurement. Okay, so the question Q, the question for Alice, QA, which is an element of Q0 or Q1, is we're just going to call this instead, well, the variable I use in the notes is A, we'll just call it A, which is an element of A0 or A1, which is either A0 or A1. So you can think of this as question 0 or question 1. These are A's, not Q's. And then that corresponds to the dial setting we're going to choose here. It's what question are we going to ask to this invisible particle? And then the pointer is the readout, and that's the answer we get. Okay, so the pointer gives us an answer, and that answer I've conveniently chosen the same notation, so it's X. So for question AJ, where J is 0 or 1, X, so there's two ways to make this theorem work. One is that we restrict the answers to be either minus 1 or plus 1, which is, this still works. Or we can actually allow any continuous variable in the range minus 1 and plus 1. Okay, so we're going to generalize this. The answer can be anything ranging from minus 1 to plus 1 inclusively. And similarly over here, we have Alice's answer, which is based on her question, which I'll call BK. Minus 1 to plus 1. And then the question BK is either one of two questions, B0 or B1. So now how do we get these questions? Well, we have lots of ways to design this experiment. Yes? These are just two real numbers. So we can make up lots of stories about what we mean by them. So they're two real numbers. They could be numbers which I could have a sheet of paper where A, the number A is on a table and A0 says, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite color, red or blue? And then question A1 could be, what's your favorite number between 17 and 42? All right, and then the answers, answer 17 would be answer minus 1, and answer 42 would be answer plus 1. So it's essentially, what I'm saying is it's arbitrary. These are just questions.
The A's are results of the measurement, or are they
dials? A's are the questions. A's refer to, so strictly speaking, if you want to design this in a lab, A is a measurement setting. So the paradigm example is people do these experiments with spin, with polarization of photons. In fact, this is exciting times. Like just last month, a paper was published which had the first like loophole-free test of Bell inequality. And I think they used electrons or something. It wasn't a photon experiment. But traditionally, these have been done with photons. And so what you do is the source is emitting entangled pairs of photons. We'll get to that later. And then what we're measuring here is the polarization of the photon. So it can either be vertical or horizontally polarized, say. And then the question is, this is a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So I have a whole bunch of different operators I can measure on the two-dimensional Hilbert space. But let me just pick two of them. So this would be measuring polarization along one axis versus measuring along a different axis. Or my favorite spin half particles. These are spin half particles, and then we measure the dipole moment along, say, the z-axis or along the x-axis. And remember, these are non-commuting measurements, so we can't do them both. We just have to pick one. And so this would be A0 would be, let me check what the spin polarization, the spin half direction is if I measure along z, and then I'm going to get an answer. I'm going to get either plus h bar over 2 or minus h bar over 2, and these map onto these two answers. Or it could be measuring x. Or it could be measuring at some axis in between z and x. In fact, that's what we're going to need to do to make this interesting. If it turns out if these questions are just measurements along the Pauli directions, we can't violate the classical bound of 75%. We violate the bound of 75% success condition when one of these measurements is at a 45-degree angle between the x and z axis. So we'll see that. So I'm just a preview. All right, so does that help clarify kind of what these things mean? So these are choices of measurement, okay, basically choice of Hermitian operator. So this is one Hermitian operator versus another Hermitian operator. And you can think of this as dial setting. So this is the dial setting A0, and this is the dial setting A1. And we turn the dial to either A1 or to A0. And then we get an answer, which is the pointer. The pointer points to either minus 1 or plus 1, and we're calling that variable x. And x is a function of the question, obviously, in each run. So everything here should be indexed by k. K is our round. Okay, so for every round, we redo the experiment. Each round, k, means there's a go button on here, and you press the go button, and that starts round 17. And then you press the go button, it starts round 18, and so on. So we do a successive rounds, and we collect data. And then we're going to analyze the data after the fact. Okay, so now optionally, we make the detectors space-like separated. Again, I think relativity is a red herring, all right? It's what we use to justify the assumption of no communication. So then people are like, oh, well, if you're violating relativity, then you're doing something wrong. But that's not the point. The point is we're violating whatever conditions you want to impose to make sure these people aren't communicating. To guarantee no communication. Okay, so what we want to avoid, the situation that this device over here sees what this pointer was, and it moves its pointer in response to what pointer it saw over there, because that's collusion. That's the collusion that allows you to win 100% of the time. Yeah?
The answer is in a continuous range from minus 1 to 1, is that?
Yeah. So this is going to work either way. We can either make this the set minus 1 and plus 1, or we can make it the continuous interval minus 1 to plus 1. The theorem applies for either scenario. So this is the more general one, obviously. So, the reason...
You could have a continuous set of answers.
You have to reformulate the rules of the game then, so I'd have to think about that. But the reason for choosing discrete answers is because we know when we're studying fundamental particles like spin half and photon polarizations, we either get one of two answers. The outcome of a measurement is always an eigenvalue. There are at most two distinct eigenvalues for projective measurement on a two-level system, and you never get an answer in between. That's quantization, right? So choosing the answers to be minus 1 and plus 1 is modeling the specific quantum scenario. But what we want is we want a theorem that applies to any theory. So even if we come up with a new version of quantum theory, quantum theory 2.0, which allows continuous outcomes, then this theorem still is going to apply to that, improved quantum mechanics. So that's why it's worth generalizing. I mean, we know we want to unify quantum theory and gravity, and so one of them probably has to be changed a little bit. Or we need some dramatically new conceptual insight about how to reconcile them without changing them. And so this is why we keep all options open. Okay, great. So now what we're going to do is we're going to encode this kind of funny set of constraints where we have an odd man out condition where we want the answers to disagree. Let's encode that with an equation. So we define a variable s. This variable s is some kind of correlation function. And what s is doing is it's saying, I want to take the sum of the averages of these three situations, and then I want to subtract the average of the odd man out situation. Okay, so what does this even mean? Okay, so expectation is an average over runs. So remember, I promised you we would collect the data and then we post-process it. So the post-processing involves averaging over entries. You pick all the entries where they both measured the same variable, not the same variable, where Alice measured her variable A0 and Bob measured his variable B0. And then we pick that subset of rows and we average over them. So for example, ALBK is defined as, and this is now I'm defining it in terms of the experimental results here. Take the limit as n goes to infinity. This is the number of runs. 1 over n. Sum of, I guess I called it k. K equals 1 to n. X in run k. Shoot, do I have it? No, okay, good. XK AL YK B. Oh, darn. That's why I shouldn't call it K. Okay. So here, let's change this each round N, little n. So then here I want this to be little n. And now I can use k as my index, as I was using here. This k is different here. This is this k. Yk, y, xn, yn, bk. This is why I should stick to the notation in my notes. Okay, so here we go. All right, so is this clear? And there was a question?
Yeah. How do we determine which measurement as we are going to make?
That's a great question. That's a great question. All right, so how do we do that? All right, so, I mean, there is no good answer to that question. All right, so we assume that there's a notion of independence. We assume in our everyday lives that there are independent events. Okay, so now there's lots of ways we can do this experiment, and they've actually been done in all of these ways, except for maybe the last one I'll mention. So the first method is that Alice and Bob just roll a die, or they look at a fluctuation in their AC power supply. But that's dangerous because if they're using the same AC power on the same grid, there could be subtle correlations in the fluctuations, right? So that's probably a bad idea. They can use different pseudo-random number generators with different seeds. They can have a little lab over here, and they can put a photon up against a polarizing beam splitter, which has a 50-50 chance of deflecting or not deflecting the photon along two paths. And based on which random outcome they get from that quantum mechanical experiment, they can use that outcome to determine the choice of measurement in a given run. That was actually done by Gregor Weiss in the 1990s. In this pioneering experiment, because people were like, oh, well, we don't believe previous tests of Bell's theorem because we had no guarantee that the choices here were random, because I think when Alain Aspect did it in the 80s, he must have used some classical source of randomness. And so people were like, well, there could have been prior correlations in your classical random source. I mean, people really pull at straws here. I mean, the point is, People don't like the conclusion of Bell's theorem, so Bell experimental tests are subjected to the kind of scrutiny that no other experiment is subjected to, because people don't want to accept the conclusion. It's like, you know, climate change denial or something, right? You just come up with all kinds of conspiracy theories because you don't want to accept the conclusion. So people are worried about that. So then what Gregor Weiss did with his team, I think he was with Zeilinger's group at the time, but I'm not sure. What he did is he actually had he did a quantum measurement of a two-level system with a 50-50 outcome and used the outcome of that randomness of that quantum event to determine the measurement setting on the apparatus that measured the incoming photon from the entangled source. So he went to a great length to guarantee independence. Okay, the final thing you can do is you can just have someone pick randomly. Now, people are really bad at generating random bit strings just from their minds. They tend to have less correlations than you see in nature. Like if you just ask someone to pick a sequence of zeros and ones, they'll kind of, and you compare it to a true random sequence. Well, there's no true random sequence. You compare it to what we think is a true random sequence. You'll get lots of sequences of like lots of 7, 8 zeros in a row, 7 or 8 ones in a row. But when people do it from the top of their head, they're like, oh, that looks unnatural. So they'll kind of auto-correct and they'll enforce more uniformity than you actually get. So the point is there's lots of ways to do it. And you just kind of pick the way that's most satisfying for you, that you've met this assumption of independence. The key point is we want the input questions to be independent. Yeah.
So when we want the average, say A0, B0, we select those runs where L is measured A0 and Bob measured B0.
Yeah. So there's going to be random entries in the table according to their random choices of measurement. We look at the row entries in the table of data where they happen to both. Alice picked the zero choice and Bob picked the zero choice, and we take that subset of rows and we calculate the average correlation in their outcomes. Okay, this is the other thing. This notation I find a little bit unsettling. It's the standard notation. So let me give you a notation that I find a little bit more intuitive. What this actually is, how many of you are familiar with writing an expectation value this way? Not many, okay. So what we're actually doing is we're actually looking at the average of x to the al, y to the bk. All right, this is what you would normally think. So this is an equivalent notation. X and y are random variables. We're averaging over their product. Okay, so here's the point. If x and y are perfectly correlated, that means for every l and k, x and y are always either plus 1 or minus 1, then this will be 1, right? So if they're perfectly correlated, we'll get 1 plus 1 plus 1 minus 1, which is 3, which corresponds to winning 3/4 of the time, which is 75%. Because here, there's a penalty for having them perfectly correlated, having the same answer. You guys look already a bit unsettled. Any questions? What's bothering you? Or you just wanted me to get to the point? Where you want the punchline, or are you just troubled with the setup? I can't read your body language here. I'll give you a minute to think about that. All right, so we've defined experimentally what the quantities are. So then we have two things left to do. One is we want to see if we can derive an upper bound on S. That's going to be Bell's theorem, which is going to be based on the assumption of independent inputs and based on the assumption of no communication. Those are the two assumptions we need. And then we also have to calculate the quantum mechanical prediction. Okay, so just as a preview, how does this experimental quantity relate to a quantum mechanical prediction? Well, you should know this. Okay, so what we're going to have is we're going to define AL let me not try and do that. We're going to define the correlation between AL and BK as the trace of row sigma dot AL sigma dot BK. And this is a tensor product symbol here. Okay, so this is Alice's system. Let's imagine it's a spin half particle. So Alice is going to measure this Pauli operator along some axis. And the axis she's going to choose is the axis defined by A hat. Okay, so this is just a standard Bloch sphere. And now A0 might be this unit vector, and A1 might be this unit vector, for example. Or we could have, let me give you the actual case. We're going to have, A0 be this vector, and A1 be this vector. So these correspond to directions in space, right? So each A sub L is a direction in R3. It's a unit vector pointing in some direction in your lab. And then what that means is if I have like a Stern-Gerlach apparatus for measuring spin half, I'm going to rotate the Stern-Gerlach apparatus so that its north-south pole axis is along this spatial direction. And that means I'm measuring the Pauli spin operator along that direction. And then Bob is going to do the same. And he has two different choices. He can have, you know, k equals 0 or k equals 1. Or k equals one axis. Well, okay, I'm getting confused between which variable is which here. But the point is there's two choices of B. And then he's measuring a spin along one of those two choices, chosen uniformly at random in each run. And then we calculate for all of the places where L and K are fixed. So each random row of our data table where L and K are fixed, we have the experimental result, and the quantum mechanical prediction for that is given by this rule. So this is undisputed. This is obviously, you know, this is one of the ways you confirm quantum mechanics. We have an experimental quantity. We have the quantum mechanical prediction. We check that they agree for all possible input states row. Quantum mechanics works. There's no doubt about that. Okay. Okay. We haven't gotten to the. Okay. So now we get to the. Now we get to the interesting part. The interesting part is the upper bound. Okay. So we're going to prove. This is Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem. So Bell's original result was improved by Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt. And so we're going to give the version of the theorem due to them. They managed to remove an assumption of determinism. And they call it the CHNSH inequality. Okay, so this result is the following. It's that S is bounded between 2 and minus 2. If S is determined as some average over some variable lambda, okay, so this minus 1 to the ij is exactly that constraint where we want the fourth outcome. We want a minus sign in front of the fourth outcome. That makes this kind of a non-trivial problem. So here I'm just defining, this is just a repetition of what we've already seen. So this isn't new. This is just a re-expression of what we already had. The piece that's new here is that we're imagining that S is obtained via this integral. Okay, so what are the physical assumptions that encode that we have this kind of a expression or realization of what S means? Lambda represents the set of physical properties that have a causal role in determining the outcome. But that's exactly the question, right? So what does lambda represent? So we have lambda may be determined probabilistically at the source. Okay, so lambda represents any common cause information, any common cause properties. That play a role in determining the outcomes. X and Y.
So is it fair to say it's just something?
Yeah, the point is we make no specific demands about what lambda is. Okay, so essentially we say, look, there are some physical properties. We assume that there are physical properties that exist, and we say lambda is those physical properties from the source. So in other words, remember, this ties into this very deep question of when we have a source, something invisible comes out, right? We want to say that there's something that comes out of the source. There's something that causally triggers this light to go off, right? This isn't just nothingness, right? Our brains are tied to this notion of some kind of mechanical interaction, right? So we imagine that there's some particle here that's an electron that has some properties, or a photon that has certain properties. So otherwise, how do we understand why I press go and then all of a sudden this light goes off? Well, it's because there was some intermediate causal factor that traveled from here to here and made this light go off. So that's the assumption we're making. In fact, we're not making any assumption about what those properties are, just that there are some things that we call properties that have some causal role in making this light go off and making this pointer pick a direction. Okay, so you can abandon that assumption and be anti-realist and say, no, no, there are no physical properties. That's fine. And then Bell's theorem does not apply. So if you want to believe that things like chairs and things have physical, things exist independently of your experience, which you don't need to do, assume that. But if you want to assume that, then that's what we're assuming, okay? That there are properties that exist independent of your experience that play a causal role here. Yeah?
So if our source just consists of these bits of entangled pairs of photons, and we believe that the wave function is a physical property or the physical property, then this role would be just a data?
Exactly. So one of the important points people usually miss is that we can allow lambda to be the wave function.
Okay, that very rarely do people pick up on that. So the point is, lambda could just be the wave function. So if you believe that the wave function is physical, in spite of me telling you not to, then you're fine. This is fine. This theorem applies. Could just be psi itself. So here lambda, I mean psi comes out of kind of both sides in a way. There's some joint psi for both the bipartite system, and that's lambda. So it's common cause information, because look, how do you get correlations? Okay, so if we had some object that's split into two halves, then conservation of I'm speaking classically, if some object is broken into two parts and one is rotating in one direction along an axis, then by conservation of angular momentum, the other fragment has to be rotating in the other direction along that axis. And then we imagine that these physical particles are correlated because of conservation of angular momentum, and then this one causes a measurement of angular momentum to yield a certain result, and this piece of this fragment causes a measurement of angular momentum to yield a different result, but they'll be correlated. So the point is, we expect correlations here due to the fact that there's a common cause source. So the genius of Bell's theorem is to realize that even after allowing for a common cause, there's still a maximum amount of correlation you can achieve. So if the measurements are perfectly aligned, then the maximum correlation is 1, right? Whenever I get this guy to be up, this guy's always down. Well, maximum correlation of -1, whatever. It's the maximum correlation. But what Bell realizes, if you actually change the direction angles a bit, then the maximum correlation is less than 1 because you're not measuring along the right choice of axis each time. And then derived an upper bound for the maximum correlation as a function of that choice. And then it turns out quantum mechanics violates that assumption. So we allow for common cause information, but what we find from the experimental data is that there's more correlation than can be explained by the common cause information. And this relates to our CHSH game, right? We know that they can, look, if they were just flipping coins, if these guys were answering questions by flipping coins, what fraction of the time are they going to win in the CHSH game? 50%. Right? By random luck, they'll win 50% of the time. But they can win 75% of the time. Why can they do better than 50%? Only if they colluded in advance. That's the common cause information. So with access to common cause information, you can do better than pure chance, and you can win 75% of the time. So here we're allowing the common cause information here, and we come up with the maximum correlation you can get even with common cause information, but we're specifically denying communication about the choices of what detector setting they chose. So that's, we're allowing common cause and we're denying communication. That's the point. Where am I? Yeah, okay, so this is, I mean, there's a lot of careful philosophy that goes into specifying what do we mean by lambda, how does this relate to, say, many worlds. So let me just tell you the big picture. This theorem does not apply to the many worlds interpretation. Okay, many worlds just denies this notion of some kind of single-valued reality is just denied. Consistent histories denies this assumption. It says, yeah, sure, there are properties that are definite, but not all the properties we would expect to be definite are definite. So they evade the consequences of the theorem by denying the assumption of realism. Of the interpretations that allow realism, like believing that the wave function is real, or believing that there are hidden variables like Bohmian mechanics, then you are forced to have those variables be non-local, which means that there are influences between these two detectors that we cannot control, but that nonetheless have a causal role. So this is the big subtlety here, which we're going to get to later, is there's a distinction between no signaling and locality. So no signaling, which is what relativity appeals to, is the idea that I can't manipulate something that's space-like separated from me. I can't send information that you can act upon outside of the light cone. Special relativity doesn't address the idea of causal factors which cannot be controlled and hence can't be used to signal. So the violation of local causality we're going to see here is not a violation of special relativity and no signaling. It's a violation of the idea that even things that we can't control and don't know about also must be local. And if we make that assumption, then we get a contradiction with the predictions of quantum mechanics. Okay, so it's a lot to digest, but I'm just kind of giving you the big picture. I'll let you think about that while I reorganize the blackboards. Okay, so lambda can vary from run to run. Okay, so we model the source with the probability distribution, rho lambda. So there's some probability of different values of lambda each time I press go, which means that we expect that we have, did I already write this out? No, not yet. Which means that we assume that we have this kind of a model. Something that's important to emphasize, for those of you who are sympathetic to many worlds, for example, which is a lot of people, the assumption of realism, which is what many worlds denies, isn't sufficient to derive a contradiction with quantum mechanics. So here we've assumed realism. We've assumed there are physical properties, that these physical properties can possibly vary in time, or this could be a delta function if we wanted. This can be a delta function if we wanted. And then we have our experimental outcomes, and this is the probability distribution of getting these experimental outcomes given the random variable lambda in each run and given the choice of measurement settings. So here we've assumed realism. So if realism was false, which is what many worlds tells us, then we would expect this alone to be sufficient to derive a contradiction with quantum mechanics. But this alone is not sufficient. We need an additional assumption, and that additional assumption is called local causality, or Bell locality. Okay, and this is a stronger assumption than no signaling. So local causality is the following assumption, that the probability of outcome XY given these choices of measurement settings, which are we assume to be independent, and given the random variable lambda that came out of the source, we assume that it turns out that we assume that the probability of getting X shouldn't depend on what outcome Y I got, because sure, X and Y both depend on these properties, but once we've provided this information, no new information is available to determine X once we know Y, right? So X is a function of these three, Y is a function of these three. Knowing Y shouldn't help me determine X because X already has this information available to it. And then you say, well, in fact, also, X shouldn't be determined by B here, right? Because B is some choice that was made at random by Bob about what direction he was going to measure. That shouldn't determine what result I get for X, right? This is basically saying, look, Bob isn't allowed to communicate with Alice in the CHS age game. So his outcome can't depend on what Alice chose to answer, and it can't depend on what question Alice was asked, because he doesn't have that information available to him. So local causality, this is also just the no communication rule. Okay, so lambda says that we can have a plan and that plan exists. And then no communication means that the probability of X can only depend on the information that goes into the box, which is lambda and A. And similarly, the probability of Y can only depend on the information that goes into the box, which is B and lambda. So this factorization assumption is implied by these are different ways of expressing the same mathematical fact. Okay, so the outcome X shouldn't depend on B, and the outcome Y shouldn't depend on A, and similarly, X shouldn't depend on Y. Okay, so let me just remark that local causality can be broken down into two more primitive assumptions. Which I've already told you, but I'm going to repeat because it's worth repeating. local causality is implied by the conjunction of two assumptions. One is parameter independence. So this is saying that the probability of X does not depend on remote choice of BK. So that means the probability of X given A, B, lambda, and Y is equal to the probability of X given A, lambda, and Y. So here we're for a moment allowing X to depend on the outcome, which we don't want to do, but we're doing it in steps. So we're just denying that B plays a role. And then now we're going to deny that Y plays a role. That's called outcome independence. So we're saying not only should X not depend on the choice of the dial for measurement apparatus B, it should also not depend on the pointer outcome for Y. So probability of X does not depend on outcome Y, which mathematically is expressed as probability of X given A, lambda, and Y is actually equal to the probability of X given just A and lambda. Okay, so these two mathematical assumptions or physical assumptions imply this factorization. You know, if one of you rolls a die and gets outcome 3, and someone over there rolls a die and gets outcome 3, we ask, what's the joint probability of that? Well, it's the probability that you got a 3 times the probability that he got a 3. So if it's 1 out of 6 here and 1 out of 6 here, the chance of you both getting 3s is 1 out of 36. So that's just saying that the probability of 3 here and 3 there is just 1/6 times 1/6. Because they're not... Now, if you happen to both have colluded and you decided to use a die which has probability half of giving a 3, and the other probability half is divided evenly between 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, and you're using the same die because you colluded, that's this prior information lambda, then you can make it so that the probability of getting 3 and 3 is a quarter. But it's still equal to a half times a half. Right, so even though you've colluded by using a biased die, the product of the joint probability is still, the probability of the joint event is still the product of the two probabilities because the die rolls were independent. Okay, I thought there was a question. Yeah.
We are assuming realism and local causality, and by that means we can derive the Bell's inequalities, right?
Right. So we will see by the experiment that the Bell's inequalities are violated, and then we can turn that game around, right? So we can just say, well, Bell's inequalities are not satisfied, therefore we have either no realism or no local causality, right? So we only have to give up one of them.
Precisely.
So I don't understand why you say that this
is... you don't only have to give up one. If you give up realism, then there's no notion of locality.
What does it mean to have locality if there's no realism? There are no properties about which you can talk about them being space-like or time-like or whatever. They don't even exist. So there's no notion of locality. So either you give up both or you just give up local causality. If I have two pool balls and they have definite colors, and then it turns out that the pool balls, they both are blue, and it turns out they're both not blue. Well, you could deny that the pool balls exist, or you could deny that they were both blue, okay? If you deny that they exist, then assigning a color to them is irrelevant because they don't even exist, right? So look, you should talk to, Gilles Brossard, because he's a many worlds guy and he denies realism and he has some crazy story about how to explain Bell's theorem in light of his interpretation. And, you know, I've learned enough. There's very few things you can say for sure about interpretations. But I would bet the mortgage that many worlds is the wrong way to think about quantum mechanics. One of the few things I'm almost certain about is that. So there's no point in talking to me, because you're not going to get any sympathy. There's so many reasons. I mean, I can tell you reasons. First of all, if you think about if you assume realism exists, then you find this really interesting boundary. And that boundary is there are quantum events that violate the local causality assumption. And it turns out that that boundary is a boundary in the space of quantum states. And it turns out that that boundary in the space of quantum states highlights resources we can leverage to achieve things that we can't achieve without that boundary. And so if you deny realism, that boundary goes away, and then you don't, I mean, the point is, by assuming realism and then finding that local causality is violated, you find interesting features in the landscape of what you can and can't do with quantum mechanics that's better than classical. By denying realism altogether, in which case this isn't even well defined anymore, then you don't find that boundary and you kind of don't realize, well, which quantum states are more useful than others? Well, I have no way of defining that because I've denied realism. Similarly, with quantum speedup, a lot of people thought, oh, well, quantum computers must be faster than classical computers because they're computing in parallel across multiple worlds or something like that, right? It hurts me to say those words, okay? But that's what people say. And you look at that and you realize, well, if that was the case, quantum advantages over classical computing should be pervasive. Almost any problem you want to solve, you should be able to solve faster with a quantum computer. And that's not true. It turns out that there are just very, very specific problems that you can solve faster with a quantum computer than a classical one. So what is the boundary that points to the kinds of resources in quantum information that allow you to solve those specific problems? It turns out it's a generalization of locality, local causality called non-contextuality. That points to an interesting boundary in the space of quantum states which trigger the possibility of quantum speedup. If you take the many worlds view, you would never even see that boundary. It doesn't even exist. So the point I'm trying to make is that it's becoming increasingly clear. So actually, this is a paper my group published in Nature last year showing that non-contextuality implies this boundary for quantum speedup. Anything inside that boundary is useless. Things outside that boundary seem to be a resource for getting quantum advantage. So I think that you're doing yourself a disservice by denying this assumption rather than exploring the consequences of this assumption. But then again, research is an open-ended program. I think it's certainly true that many of the great scientists that realized that quantum information was enabling have the many worlds point of view. So it can be the case that different ways of thinking about quantum interpretations give distinct insights to those distinct individuals, which they leverage then to prove mathematically things that are, you know, scientifically indisputable. So, I mean, you know, there's value in thinking creatively about quantum mechanics. Different points of view shouldn't be shut out, but I think some points of view are more valuable than others, and that's my personal opinion, so I'm giving it. But anyways, we can talk about this over a beer sometime, okay? All right, next. So, I mean, I'm a little bit defensive about it because I'm in a minority, right? I mean, most physicists believe in many worlds and don't think that the way I think about quantum mechanics is a useful way to think about it. So I kind of am fighting this uphill battle already, which is why, you know, you get both barrels right now. All right. So, and let me just make one conceptual point, which I don't want you to miss, which is that we're not denying correlations here. I've already said this, but let me just show you what it means mathematically. We're not denying correlations. Okay, so if there were no correlations, if we had uncorrelated events, then we would be saying that the probability of X, Y given A, B is equal to the probability of X given A times the probability of Y given B. Let me just remember how this argument works. Right. So right. So this is fully uncorrelated. We're allowing there to be correlations. So a correlated outcomes can arise by conditioning on lambda. So here lambda is the common cause information. So if we say this is true, we're saying that there's essentially, you know, no possibility of correlation. And here we're allowing for correlation due to the common cause. So common cause, which is in the shared backward light cone. Can produce correlations. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, what's the maximum amount of correlation that we can that can be explained by this common cause factor? Even though we've placed no conditions on what lambda is. Okay, lambda can be 10 to the 23 variables. It can be anything. It can be the wave function itself. It can be the wave function and 10 to the 23 other variables. It can just be, you know, definite values of angular momentum for some physical angular momentum. It can be anything. Okay, so now we get to the finally, do you guys mind going an extra 10 minutes? I can give you the proof. What? It's okay? All right, so here's the proof. Okay, so I've defined A and B somewhere here. So my realism let me write this out this way. My local causality let me do this, which was cash out this guy as this product. So that means I have that each of these terms, ALBK, fortunately I call it IJ here. And let's put lambda, because this is the expectation given some particular value of lambda, is equal to the sum over the different outcomes XY, the product of the outcomes, and now here we've imposed realism and local causality. And now because of this, notice that this object and this object don't depend on y, and this probability and y, of course, don't depend on x, which means this is a product of two terms. Which we can just define this to be AI okay, so then we have S of lambda is equal to A0 B0 plus A1 B0 plus A1 A0 B1 minus A1 B1. And now we just do a little bit of mathematics. Okay, so we've made all our assumptions. Now the rest is just math. So then we realize that, look, each AI is going to be in the interval minus 1 to plus 1, just as a normalization condition. Similarly for the B variable. Okay, so that means that S lambda, we can rearrange. So now we're going to rearrange terms. So this is the trick. So the trick is to write it out as A0 times B0 plus B1 plus A1 times B0 minus B1. Okay? So once you realize that you can rearrange in this way, and then we realize that, well, this guy and this guy are both bounded between 1 and minus 1, then we can write down an inequality, which is this term will be no bigger than the magnitude of B0 plus B1, and this term will be no bigger than the magnitude of B0 minus B1. What's amazing is that this inequality is tight. So whenever you see an inequality, you think, okay, I'm throwing away some cases. But it turns out that these inequalities are tight. And then without loss of generality, let's just assume that one of these guys is bigger. So let's just assume that B0 is greater than or equal to B1. Okay, then it follows that S lambda is less than or equal to twice B0. If you prefer that B1 is bigger, then just put B1 there, which is less than or equal to 2 because this is bounded by 1 and minus 1. And then now remember, S itself is defined as the integral over d lambda over the randomness of the source. We don't need the source to be random, but to be completely general, we allow the source to be random. And that's only going to decrease, I mean, you know, that's only going to decrease the average. Okay, so then, and then by a symmetrical argument, we get the other bound, the lower bound of minus 2. By a symmetrical argument, we get that S is bounded above by 2 and bounded below by minus 2. Okay, and then the punchline is, that's not a big deal. The punchline is that with QM, we have S is equal to 2 times the square root of 2 for certain choices of measurement. For certain choices of input state and directions of measurement, which we'll do next class. This is the upper limit. Yeah, but the important point is we can reach this limit. So there exist choices of states and measurement direction where the quantum mechanical prediction is 2 root 2. So when people do experiments, I mean, what I started with was the experimental quantity. Where did I write it? Here, this experimental quantity S. And so we do the experiments, and what we find is S is greater than 2. So you want to show that your certain number of standard deviations based on your statistical error, because this is a statistical average, you want to show that you're some number of standard deviations above 2. And of course, you can't be 2 root of 2, you're showing quantum mechanics is wrong. Okay, so the experimental results are between 2 and 2 root 2. And getting as close to 2 root 2 as possible is a technical challenge. And doing it with an experimental setup that respects the assumptions. So we can talk more about this next class, but let me just say that just last month, people finally published a loophole-free Bell inequality experiment, which has been a holy grail for some 20 years, 30 years. And there's only one loophole that can't be closed, and that's what you brought up, is how do we guarantee that the choices of measurement settings are independent? Because, you know, this question runs very deep. It's ultimately the issue here is, you know, if you believe in determinism, if you haven't let go of classical mechanics yet and you still believe the world is deterministic, then any choices Alice and Bob make, whether it's a pseudo-random number generator or the outcomes of polarization measurements or random choices they make in their brains, those are causally determined backwards in time, going all the way back to the Big Bang. So there's no real true notion of independence. I mean, we see independence all the time, and it's an operating principle for doing quantum mechanics, doing tests, I mean, experimental tests. But ultimately, we have no way to justify it. So, I mean, there's an issue. But then people realize, well, look, even if I allow that these aren't independent events, it's not enough just to say that they're not independent to explain a violation of Bell inequality. It's that they have to be not independent in just the right way that you happen to see these funny correlations that exceed two. So this is called the superdeterminism argument. That at the Big Bang, the seeds were planted for a deterministic world exactly so that there were events that look like they are random and independent, but only when people do Bell experiments, they turn out not to be independent. So you can believe that if you wish, and then you don't have to confront a violation of locality. But I mean, you have to make a judgment call about what's more plausible, right? All right, we've gone too long. We can chat over lunch, and also we can continue some discussion of this next class. Thanks for your attention and questions today.